The other four security people kept their guns trained on him the entire time. "That was smart," Murtry said. He pulled a tissue out of a box on his desk and wiped the blood from his forehead. He had an ugly bruise forming around the cut Amos's pistol had left.
"Your boy almost didn't make it out of this room, Mediator."
Holden surprised himself by laughing. "I've never seen Amos pick a fight he didn't plan to win. I'm not sure what he had in mind, but even at 5-1, my money would be on him."
"Everyone loses eventually," Murtry said. "Or it's to live by." "That's quite the killer you have working for you, as critical as you are of my methods."
"There's a difference. Amos is willing to lose face to protect something he loves. He doesn't need to win more than he needs to keep his friends alive. And that's why you're nothing alike." Murtry agreed with a nod and a shrug.
"So, if you weren't here to save your man, then what?"
"We keep escalating," Holden said. "Some of that is my fault. I asked Naomi to deal with the shuttle."
"Sabotage," Murtry started,
"but I did that in response to finding out you'd weaponized it. We keep reacting to what the person before us did, justifying ourselves like kids on a playground. He started it."
"So you'll be the first to break the cycle?"
"If I can," Holden said.
"You've gone too far, Murtry.
Disable the shuttle, give me Naomi back. Let's see if we can find a way to stop the escalation." Murtry's vague smile shifted to an equally vague frown. The man leaned back on his desk and touched another tissue to the cut on his forehead. It came away with a single crimson spot. Then he folded his arms, casual but immovable. Holden knew that it was a deliberate affectation intended to look natural. He was both impressed and worried by anyone who had that level of self-awareness and control.
"I've acted entirely within the purview of my assignment here," Murtry said. "I've protected RCE assets and personnel."
"You've killed a bunch of colonists and kidnapped my XO, Holden replied, trying to keep the anger out of his voice and failing.
"I've killed fewer squatters than they've killed of us, all of which were actively engaged in plotting and carrying out attacks on RCE assets and personnel, which, as I said, is my job. And Naomi, and I captured a saboteur, and I'm holding her pending an investigation. Kidnapping is not only a provocative term, it's inaccurate."
"You want this to blow up," Holden sighed. "You can't wait for the next chance to make things worse, can you?" The frown shifted back to the smile. Neither meant anything, just different masks. Holden wondered what it looked like inside Murtry's head, and shuddered.
"I've done the minimum necessary at each step," the man said, through his disquieting grin.
"No," Holden replied. "You could have left. You had the Israel. After the first attack on the shuttle, you could have pulled your people out and waited for the investigation. A lot of people would still be alive if you had."
"Oh no," Murtry said, shaking his head.
He stood up and uncrossed his arms, every movement slow and deliberate and conveying threat.
"No, that's one thing we won't do. We won't give up a centimeter of ground. These squatters can throw themselves against us until every one of them is shattered into dust, but we're not going anywhere, because that..."
Murtry's smile sharpened.
"Is also my job."
The walk from the RCE security shed back to his room at the community center wasn't a long one, but it was very dark. Miller's faint blue glow illuminated nothing, but it was oddly comforting anyway.
"Hey, old man," Holden said in greeting. "We need to talk."
Miller grinned at his own joke.
He made jokes now.
He was almost like a real person. Somehow, that was more frightening than when he'd been insane.
"I know, but I'm kind of busy with keeping these people from killing each other. Or, you know, us." "How's that working for you?"
"Terrible," Holden admitted. I've just lost the only real threat I had to make.
Yep, Naomi being on their ship makes the Rosinante a non-factor. Letting her anywhere near that ship was a dumb mistake.
I never told you about that.
Should I pretend I'm not inside your head?
Miller asked with a belter shrug.
I'll do it if it makes you more comfortable.
Hey, Miller, Holden said. What am I thinking now?
Points for creativity, kid. That'd be difficult to pull off and less fun than you might expect.
So stay out.
Miller stopped walking and grabbed Holden's upper arm. Again, he was surprised at how real it felt. Miller's hand felt like iron gripping him.
Holden tried to pull away and couldn't. And all of it was just the ghost pushing buttons in his brain.
Wasn't kidding. We need to talk.
Well, spit it out, Holden replied, finally yanking his arm away when Miller let go.
There's a spot away north of here I need to go look at.
By which you mean you need me to go look at?
Yeah,
Miller said with a belter nod of one fist.
That.
Against his will, Holden felt his curiosity piqued. What is it?
So, turns out our coming here caused a little ruckus with the locals, Miller said. May have noticed. A lot of leftover stuff waking up all over the planet.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that.
Is that you?
Can you control it?
Are you kidding? I'm a sock puppet. Protomolecule's got its arm so far up my ass I can taste its fingernails,
Miller laughed.
I can't even control myself.
It's just that some of it seems dangerous. That robot, for instance. And you were able to turn off the station in the slow zone.
Because it wanted me to. You can order the sun to come up if you time it right. I'm not driving this bus. Making it do what I want would be like talking someone out of a seizure.
Okay, Holden said. We've got to get off this planet.
Before that, though, there's this thing. This not thing. Look, I've got a pretty good map of the global network. Lots of leftover stuff coming up, checking in. Except one spot. Like a big ball of nothing.
Holden shrugged.
Maybe it's just a place where there are no nodes on the network.
Kid, this whole planet is a node on the network. There shouldn't be any place that's off limits to me.
So what does it mean?
Maybe it's just a spot that's really, really broken, Miller said.
That'd be interesting, but useless.
And the useful thing?
It's a leftover bit of whatever killed this place.
They stood in silence for a moment, the cool evening wind of Illis ruffling Holden's pants, and not affecting the detective at all. Holden felt a chill start at the base of his spine and slowly climb his back. The hairs on his arms stood up.
I don't want to find that, he finally said. And I do,
Miller replied with his best attempt at a friendly smile.
Free will left the conversation for me a while back.
But that's where the clues are.
You should come with.
It's going to happen eventually anyway.
Why is that?
Because real monsters don't go away when you close your eyes. Because you need to know what happened here just as bad as I do. Miller's expression was still friendly, but there was a dread in it too, a fear that Holden recognized and shared.
Naomi first. I don't go anywhere until we get her back.
Miller nodded again and flew apart into a spray of blue fireflies. Amos was waiting for him when he got back to the bar. The big man sitting alone at a table with a half-empty bottle of something that smelled like antiseptic and smoke.
I'm guessing you didn't kill him after I left, Amos said as Holden sat down.
I feel like I'm walking a tightrope so narrow I can't even see it.
Holden replied. He shook his head when Amos offered him the bottle, so the mechanic took a long swig from it instead.
This ends in blood,
Amos said after a moment. His voice sounded distant, dreamlike.
No way around that.
Well, since my job is pretty much exactly the opposite of that, I hope you're wrong.
I'm not.
Holden lacked a compelling argument, so instead he said, What did Alex have to say?
We put together a list of demands for the captain of the Israel. Make sure Naomi gets well taken care of while she's there.
What will we give up in exchange?
Alex isn't blowing the Israel into its component atoms right this second.
I hope they agree we're being generous.
He is, however, Amos continued, keeping a constant railgun lock on the Israel's reactor.
Holden ran his fingers through his hair.
So, not too generous then.
Say, pretty please, but carry a 1 kilo slug of tungsten accelerated to a detectable percentage of C.
I believe I've heard that said, Holden replied, then stood up.
He suddenly felt very tired.
I'm going to bed. Naomi's in Murtry's goddamn brig and you can sleep,
Amos said and took another drink.
No, but I can go to bed. Then tomorrow, I'm going to figure out how to get my first officer back from the RCE maniac holding her hostage, so that I can go and find the scary alien bullet fragment embedded in the planet.
Amos nodded, as if that all made sense.
Nothing in the afternoon, then.
Chapter 24. Elvie slept. And she dreamed. In her dream, she was back on Earth, which was also the corridors of the Edward Israel. A sense of urgency pressed at her, shifting quickly toward dread. Something was on fire somewhere because she hadn't turned in the right forms. She had to file the forms before everything burned. She was in the bursar's office at the university, and Governor Trying was there too. Only he was waiting for his death certificate, and it was taking too long. She couldn't submit her forms. She looked at the onion skin papers, trying to find the submission deadline, but the words kept changing. First, the line at the bottom read, Elvie Okoye, lead researcher and Argonaut. And the next time she read it, Fines to be paid directly at the temple, rabbits and hogs. The urgency pushed at her, and when she shouted, the onion skin started coming apart in her fingers. She tried to press the forms back together, but they wouldn't go. Someone touched her shoulder, and it was James Holden, only he looked like someone else. Younger, darker, but she knew it was him. She realized she'd been naked this whole time. She was embarrassed, but also a little pleased. His hand touched her breast and, Elvie, wake up. Her eyes opened, the lids heavy and slow. Her eyes struggled to focus. She didn't know where she was, only that some dumb bastard was interrupting something she didn't want interrupted. The dark lines before her slowly became familiar. The roof of her hut. She shifted. Reaching out for someone, but already uncertain who. She was alone in her bed. Her hand terminal glowed dimly. Her analysis equipment flickered as data from her work flew up and out through the vast darkness to the ring and Medina station, to Earth, and answering information flew back out to her. Which was all fine, and as it should be. So why the hell was she awake? A soft knock came at the door, and Fires' voice, Elvie, wake up! You've got to see this! Elvie yawned so deeply her jaw ached with it. She pulled herself up to sitting. The dream was already fading quickly. There had been something about a fire, and someone touching her whom she had badly wanted to be touched by. The details lost all coherence as she sat up and reached for her robe.
Elvie?
Are you there?
When she spoke, her words were slow, heavy, a little slurred.
If this isn't important, I will rip your throat open and piss down your lungs.
Fayez laughed. There were other voices behind his, Sudyam saying something too low to make out the words, Ima Chapel, the geochemistry lead too. Elvi paused, threw off the robe and pulled on her real clothes and work boots to go with them. When she stepped out of her hut, a dozen of the people in the research teams were standing in pairs or small groups all across the night-dark plain. They were all looking up. And in the high darkness, something larger than a star glowed a sullen red. Fayez, squatting on the ground, glanced over at her.
What is that?
Elvi asked, her voice instinctively low, as if she might startle it.
One of the moons.
She stepped forward, her neck back, scowling up at the night.
What's it doing?
Melting.
Why?
Right?
Fayez said, standing up. Sudyam, to their left, raised her voice.
Makes you wish we'd sent probes there, doesn't it?
We're one ship, and this is a whole damn planet, Fayez said. Plus which, we've been focusing a lot of effort on killing each other.
Point being? Sudyam asked.
Fayez spread his hands wide.
We've been busy.
The moon shifted colors for a moment, turning from dull red to a bright orange to yellow-white, and then back down the spectrum again, waning as suddenly as it had waxed.
Is anyone recording this?
Elvi asked.
Kasky and Ferengir aborted the high-altitude refraction study and started sucking down data from it as soon as they saw it was happening. Mostly it's visible light, heat, and about 30% more gamma particles than background. The sensor array on the Israel showing about the same thing.
Is it dangerous?
Elvi asked, knowing the answer even as she spoke the words.
Maybe. Maybe it was dangerous. Maybe it wasn't.
Until they knew what it was, all they could do was guess. In the starlight, Fayez's expression was difficult to make out. The apprehension in the corners of his mouth and in the curve of his eyes might only have been her imagination. Another kind of dream.
Do the others know?
I guess so, Fayez said, assuming they're not too busy taking each other prisoner and setting people on fire.
You told Murtry?
I didn't. Someone probably did.
And Holden, what about him? Does he know?
Even if he does, what's he going to do about it? Speak to it reassuringly?
Elvi turned toward First Landing. The few lit houses were like a handful of stars fallen to the ground. She took out her hand terminal, setting its screen to white and using it as a torch.
Where are you going?
Fayez called from behind her.
I'm going to talk to Captain Holden, she said.
Of course you are, Fayez said with an impatient grunt. Because what would be useful for him is a biologist's perspective on it. The words stung a little, but Elvi didn't let herself be drawn into the conversation. Fayez was a good scientist and a friend, but his habit of making fun of everything and derailing anything serious for the sake of humor also made him less useful than he should have been. One of the others should have made sure everyone knew that something was happening overhead. It shouldn't have had to be her. And still, she quietly did hope that she would be the one to bring the news. The dry air smelled like dust and the tiny, night-blooming flower analogues. Where there had been a few tough, ropey plants, months of foot traffic had made paths, and Elvi followed them as easily in the near darkness as she would have in the day. It occurred to her, not for the first time, that the scattering of huts, the ruins, and even First Landing itself had become as familiar to her as any place else she'd lived. She knew the land, the feel of the breezes, the smells that rose and fell at different times of day.
Over the past month, she had been the ears and eyes of the whole scientific community back in the solar system. Even when the terrorists had killed Reeve and Murtry had come down, at least a part of her day had been running samples and transmitting data back home. She had spent more time not just in, but with this environment than anyone else. Above her, the tiny red moon reminded her that she still didn't know much. Normally, that would have been a delight and a challenge. In the darkness of the new Terran night, it felt like a threat. Her steps took on a rhythm, her boots tapping against the wind-paved stones. In the town, people were in the streets, much like they had been out by the RCE huts. They stood in the streets and on their little cobbled-together porches, looking up at the glowing dot as it drifted toward the horizon. Elvie couldn't say if they were curious or apprehensive, or just wanting something to think about that wasn't the conflict between RCE and the squatters, between us and them. Or maybe they were seeing it as an omen. The burning eye looking down on them all, judging them and preparing for war. She'd heard a folk tale like that once, but she didn't remember where. Wei and one of the other RCE security men were walking down the main street, rifles at the ready. Elvie nodded to them, and they nodded back, but no one spoke. Probably someone had told Holden. But she'd come all this way. She should at least be sure. In the street outside the commissary where Holden was living, Jacek Mertin was pacing. The boy's body leaned into the motion, his hands at his sides clenched in fists. His gaze was fixed about 3 feet in front of him, like someone looking at a screen, and his shoulders were hunched in like he was protecting something. She was about to say hello when a small warning bell chimed in her head. Between one heartbeat and the next, she wasn't Elvie Okoye, going in the middle of the night to see Captain Holden on pretenses that even she could see were pretty damn flimsy. That wasn't the son of Lucia and Bajia Mertin, brother of Felsia, in front of her. This wasn't even a town. She was a biologist in the field, seeing a primate. And in that frame of reference, some things were perfectly clear. The boy was working himself up to violence. She hesitated and started to turn back. Wei was only a few dozen meters and a corner or two away. If Elvie shouted, the security people would probably come at a run. Her pulse was quick. She could feel it in her throat. The long hours after Reeve's death came back to her like a recurring nightmare. She should scream. She should call for help. Except the boy wasn't just a primate. Wasn't just an animal. He was Felsia's brother, and if she called for help, they might kill him. She swallowed, caught between fear and courage, uncertain. What would Faez do, she wondered. Offer the kid a beer? He stopped and looked up at her. His eyes were empty. He wore a light jacket that pulled down a little on one side like he had something heavy in his pocket. Hi, she said, smiling. A moment later, Jacek said, Hi. Weird, isn't it? She pointed up at the red dot. It seemed more pretentious than ever. Jacek glanced up at the sky, but didn't seem to react to it. Weird, he agreed. They stood in front of each other, the silence rich and tense. The light spilling from the commissary windows left the boy half in light, half in shadow. Elvie struggled, trying to find something to say. Some way to diffuse everything and make it all okay. Faez would have made a joke, something that the boy could laugh at and that would put them both on the same side of the laughter, and Elvie didn't know what it was. I'm scared, she said instead, her voice breaking a little. It surprised the boy as much as it did her. I'm just so scared. It's okay, Jacek said. It's just some kind of reaction up there. It's not like it's doing anything but melting up in orbit. Still scared, though.
Jacek scowled at his feet, torn between the errand he'd been steeling himself for and the impulse to say something kind and reassuring to this obviously unstable, vulnerable, strange woman.
It'll be okay? He tried.
You're right, she said, nodding. It's just, you know. I mean, you do know, don't you?
I guess.
I was coming to see Captain Holden, she said, and Jacek's eyes flickered like she'd said something insulting.
Were you too?
She could see in his face, as he tried to bring back the blankness he'd had before, the tightness and anger and emptiness. He wasn't someone for whom violence came naturally. He'd had to put effort into it. It was that effort she'd seen in him.
He took my father away, Jacek said. Mom worries we'll never see him again.
Is that why you came?
To ask?
Jacek looked confused.
Ask? What?
To talk to your father.
The boy blinked, and he took an unconscious step toward her.
He won't let me talk to him. He took him prisoner.
People talk to prisoners all the time. Did someone tell you that you couldn't talk to your dad?
Jacek was silent. He put his hand into his jacket pocket, the heavy one, and then took it out again.
No?
Come on, then, Elvis said, moving toward him. Let's go ask him.
Inside the commissary, Holden was pacing from the front of the room to the back to the front again. The big man, Amos, sat at the table with a pack of cards, playing solitaire with an unnerving focus. Holden's face was paler than usual, and the sense of barely restrained emotion gave his body a tension that she didn't picture him with.
Amos looked up as she walked in, her hand on Jacek's shoulder.
His eyes were flat and empty as marbles, and his voice was just as cheerful as ever.
Hey there, Doc. What's up?
Couple things, Elvis said.
Holden stopped. It seemed to take him a second to focus. Something was bothering him. His gaze locked on her, and he tried to smile. An unexpected tightness came to her throat. She coughed.
Jacek was wondering if there was any way he could talk with his father, Elvis said.
There didn't seem to be much air in the room. She was having a hard time catching her breath. Maybe she was developing allergies.
Sure, Holden said, then looked over his shoulder at Amos.
That's not a problem, is it?
Radios still work, Amos said. Might want to give Alex the heads up to expect it. His hands are kind of full right now.
Good point, Holden said, nodding to himself as much as any of them.
I'll set that up. Do you have a hand terminal?
It took Jacek a moment to realize the question was directed at him.
It doesn't work. We don't have a hub. It's all just line of sight.
Bring it over when you can, and I'll see if I can't put it on our network. That'll be easier than setting up times for you to use mine. Will that work?
Yeah, sure.
She could feel the boy's shoulder trembling.
Jacek turned and walked out without meeting anybody's gaze, but especially avoiding hers.
The door closed behind him.
Kid was packing, boss, Amos said.
I know, Holden replied. What did you want me to do about it?
No, that's all.
Okay, I know. But I really don't have time to get shot right now. He turned his attention to her. A lock of hair was dropping down over his forehead, and he looked tired, like he was carrying the whole planet on his back. Still, he managed a little smile.
Is there anything else? Because we're a little...
Is this a bad time? Because I can...
Our XO got arrested by Murtry, Amos said,
and the flatness of his eyes had gotten into his voice now.
Maybe a while before there's a really good time.
Oh, Elvie said, her heart suddenly picking up its pace. The XO is Holden's lover, and Holden has a lover, and Holden may not have a lover anymore, and Jesus, what am I doing here? All collided somewhere in her neocortex. Elvie found she was very unsure what to do with her hands. She tried putting them in her pockets, but that felt wrong, so she took them out again. I've been thinking, she said, her voice rising at the end of the word, even though it wasn't a question, about the thing in the desert. And now with the moon?
Which moon? The one that's melting down, Cap, Amos said.
Right, that one. I'm sorry, I've got a lot of things going on right now. If it's not something I can actually do something about, it's not sinking in the way it probably ought to, Holden said. And then, I'm not supposed to do anything about the moon thing, am I?
We can let the scientists tell us if we're supposed to freak out, Amos said. It's all right.
I've been thinking about hibernation failure rates, and that maybe what we're seeing was analogous.
Holden lifted his hands.
I couldn't tell you.
It's just that hibernation is a really very risky strategy. We only see it when conditions are so bad that the usual kinds of survival strategy would fail. Bears, for instance, they're top predators. The food web in wintertime couldn't sustain them. Or spadefoot toads in the deserts? In the dry periods, their eggs would just desiccate, so the adults go dormant until there's rain, and then they come back awake and go out to the puddles and mate furiously. Just this mad kind of puddle orgy, and, anyway, and then they lay their eggs in the water before they can dry out again.
Okay, Holden said.
My point is, Elvie said, not all of them wake up. They don't have to. As long as enough of the organisms reactivate when the time comes, enough that the population survives, even if individuals don't, it's never 100%. And shutting down and coming back up is a complicated, dangerous process. Holden took a deep breath and ran his hands through his hair. He had thick, dark hair. It looked like he hadn't washed it in a while. Amos lost his game, scooped up the cards, and started shuffling them with slow, deliberate movements.
So, Holden said, you think that these things we're seeing are artifacts or organisms or something trying to wake up?
And failing, at least sometimes, she said. I mean, the moon melted, and that thing in the desert was clearly broken. Or anyway, that's what it was looking like to me.
Me too, Holden said.
But just because it was moving, we kind of knew things were waking up.
No, that's not the point, Elvie said. There are always a small percentage of organisms that don't wake up or wake up wrong. But these things, if that's the model, they're the ones waking up wrong.
Following you so far, Holden said.
Failure rates are usually low. So why aren't we seeing a bunch of things waking up right?
Holden went over to the table and sat on its edge. He looked frightened, vulnerable. It was strange seeing a man who'd done so much, who'd made himself known across all civilization by his words and deeds, look so fragile.
So you think there are more of these things, maybe a lot more, that are activating and we're just not seeing it?
It would fit the model, she murmured.
All right, he said, and a moment later, this isn't making my day better.
Chapter 25. Baja. Baja sat alone on the operations deck of the Rocinante. He was belted into a crash couch next to what he'd been told was the comm station. The controls were quiet, waiting for someone to request a connection, occasionally flashing a system status message across its screen. The messages were incomprehensible mixtures of acronyms, system names, and numbers. The text was in a gentle green font that made Baja think they weren't particularly urgent. Alex was in the cockpit. The hatch closed.
That didn't mean anything. The hatches closed automatically to seal each deck from the others in case of atmosphere loss. It was a safety measure, nothing more. It still felt like being locked out. The panel startled him with a burst of static followed by a voice. The volume was just loud enough that Bhajia could tell it was a conversation between two men, without understanding any of the words. A red recording status blinked in one corner of the screen. The Rocinante, monitoring and recording all of the radio transmissions around Illis. Maybe Holden was doing that on purpose, to have a record of his mission when he returned to Earth. Or maybe warships did it by default. It wasn't something that a welder had to worry about. Or a miner. Or whatever he'd been with Coop and Kate. Bhajia was looking for a way to turn up the volume and listen in when Alex's voice blared from the panel.
Got a call coming in.
Okay, Bhajia said, not sure if the pilot could hear him. He didn't know if he needed to press a button to respond. The message on the comm panel changed and a male voice said,
You don't need to do anything.
For a moment, Bhajia had the irrational feeling that the person speaking had read his mind. He was about to reply when another voice, younger, male, said, Just talk? Jacek. The second voice was Jacek. And now Bhajia recognized the older voice as Amos Burton, the man who'd guarded him at the landing field.
Yeah, Amos said. I've opened a connection to the Rossi.
Hello? Jacek said.
Hey, son,
Bhajia replied around the lump in his throat.
They made our hand terminal work again, Jacek said.
By they, Bhajia guessed he meant Holden and Amos.
Oh, yeah?
Bhajia said.
That's real good.
It only talks to the ship, Jacek said, his young boy's voice bright with excitement. It doesn't play videos or anything like it used to.
Well, maybe they can make it do that too, later.
They said someday we'll be on the network, like every place in Sol System. Then we can do whatever.
That's true, Bhajia said.
Water was building up in his eyes, making it hard to see the little messages flashing by on the screen.
We'll get a relay and a hub, and then we can send data back and forth through the gates.
We'll have everything on the network then.
There's still going to be a lot of lag.
Yeah,
Jacek said, then stopped. There was a long silence.
What's the ship like?
Oh, it's pretty great,
Bhajia said with forced enthusiasm. I have my own room and everything. I met Alex Kamal. He's a pretty famous pilot.
Are you in jail?
Jacek asked.
No, no. I get to go anywhere I want on the ship. They're really nice. Good people.
I love you. I am so sorry. Please, please be all right.
Does he let you fly it?
I never asked, Bhajia said with a laugh. I'd be scared to, though. It's big and fast. Lots of guns on it.
There was another long silence. Then Jacek said,
You should fly it and blow up the RCE ship.
I can't do that,
Bhajia said, putting as much smile in his voice as he could, making it a joke.
But you should.
How's your mom?
Okay,
Jacek said. Bhajia could almost hear the shrug in his voice.
Sad. I started playing soccer more. We have enough for two teams, but we trade players a lot.
Oh, yeah? What do you play?
Fullback right now, but I want to play striker.
Hey, defense is important. That's an important job.
It's not as fun,
Jacek said, again with the verbal shrug. There was a long silence, while both of them reached for something to say. Something that could be said. Jacek gave up first.
I'm gonna go now, okay?
Hey, wait a minute, Bhajia said, trying to keep the thickness in his throat from changing his voice.
trying to keep his tone light, fun. Don't run off yet. I need to ask you to do something.
Got a game, Jacek said. Pretty soon, they'll get mad.
Your mom, Baja said. Then had to stop and blow his nose into the sleeve of his shirt.
Mom what?
Your mom will work too much, if you don't watch her. She gets to looking things up at night, medical things, and she won't get enough sleep. I need you to make sure she gets some sleep.
Okay.
It's serious, boy. I need you to look after her. Your sister's gone, and that's good, but it just leaves you to help out. You're gonna help out with this?
Okay.
Jacek said. Baja couldn't tell if the boy was sad or angry, or distracted.
See you, son, Baja said.
See ya, Pop,
Jacek replied.
Love you,
Baja said. But the signal had already died. Baja wiped his eyes with the sleeves of his shirt. He floated against his restraints, breathing deep, ragged breaths for a full minute, then pulled himself over to the crew ladder. He moved aft, deck hatches opening at his approach and slamming shut behind him as he went, the sound echoing through the empty ship. He changed shirts in his room, then spent a few minutes in the head cleaning his face with wet towels. They had a large shower unit. He couldn't remember the last time he had had a real shower, but it only worked when the ship was under thrust. When he no longer looked like a man who'd been bawling, Baja floated back along the ladder to the cockpit. He was considering whether or not it was polite to knock before entering, when he drifted too close to the hatch's electronic eye, and it snapped open with a hiss. Alex was belted into the pilot's chair, the large display directly in front of him spooling out ship's status reports and a rendering of Illis, its single, massive continent dotted with red and yellow marks, and one green dot that was first landing. The pilot scowling at the screen tensely, as though he could will the universe to do something, like he could make it give his crew back. Baja was turning to leave when the deck hatch banged shut and Alex looked up.
Hey, he said, and tapped out something on the panel. Hello, Baja said. How'd your call go? Everything okay?
Fine. Thank you for letting me use the radio.
No problem, partner, Alex said with a laugh. They don't charge us by the hour.
An uncomfortable silence stretched out that Alex pretended not to notice by pressing buttons on his controls.
Am I allowed to be up here?
Baja finally asked.
I don't mind, Alex said. Just, you know, don't mess with anything.
Baja pulled himself into the chair behind Alex and belted in. The armrests of the chair ended with complex-looking joysticks, so Baja was careful not to bump them.
That's the gunner's seat,
Alex said, turning his entire chair around to face Baja.
Should I not? No, it's fine. It ain't on. Push buttons there all you want. Hey, want to see something cool?
Baja nodded and put his hands on the two control sticks. They were covered with buttons. The gunner's seat. Those sticks might control the Rosinante's lethal weaponry. He wished Jacek could see him sitting there, holding the controls. Alex turned around and did something on his own panel, and the screen in front of Baja came to life with a view matching Alex's own. Baja looked at the bright limb of his planet, trying to find the location of first landing. Without the green dot overlay, it was impossible in daylight. If they were on the night side, he could have spotted them as a spark of light. Alex did something else, and the view shifted to a dull red blob of molten rock.
That's the moon going meltdown. It wasn't a very big one, but still kind of makes you wonder what could melt a hunk of rock that size.
Do we know?
Hell no. Some kind of alien proto-molecule shit'd be my guess.
Before Baja could ask for more details, the radio squawked at them.
Alex here, the pilot said. Kid's gone. Wanted to check in, Amos's voice said. How's the captain doing? Alex asked. Not great, and once again he stopped me from doing the obvious thing. Shooting the RCE chief in the face? Aw, Amos said. Warms my heart how well you know me. They got her, buddy, Alex said, his voice firm but gentle. Don't do anything that makes it worse. Yeah, yeah. You just watch the captain's back down there, Alex continued. I'll take care of RXO. If they hurt her? Then it'll be raining RCE parts down on Illus for a year. Won't actually help, Amos said with a sigh. No, Alex agreed. No, it won't. It'll happen, though. All right. Gonna go find the captain. Amos out. Alex tapped on his controls, and the view swung around away from the planet. For a moment, there was nothing. And then a tiny flicker of light, no more than a single pixel. The view zoomed in until it became a massive ship painted with the RCE colors. After a moment, it zoomed again, the rear of the ship swelling until it filled the screen, a small red crosshair glowing in the center of the view.
Got my eyes on you, Alex said under his breath.
What's that? Baja asked, pointing at the crosshair.
That's where the reactor sits. The Rossi's got a lock on that location. I can send a gauss round right through her heart faster than her first alarm bell can ring.
Won't that, you know?
He made an explosive motion with his hands.
No, it'll just vent. Probably kill a lot of their engineering staff.
Do they know you're aiming at them?
Not yet, but I'm about to fill them in. That's what'll keep my XO breathing.
Nice that you can do something to protect her, Baja said, and meant to stop, but the words pressed out past his teeth.
My daughter is on the Barbapicola. My wife and son are down on Illus. I can't do anything to help them or protect them.
Baja waited for the empty words of reassurance.
Yeah, Alex said. You really fucked that one up, didn't you?
Alex tapped something on his screen, and the words "railgun armed" glowed red for a second over the image of the Edward Israel.
I need to call over to that ship in a sec, Alex said.
Warn them.
More like threaten them, Alex said. Pretty much the shittiest thing we have to offer for someone we all love, but it's what we got left.
He reached out and fiddled with something on the bulkhead, and a stream of cool air shot out of the vent. It ruffled the pilot's thinning black hair and dried the sweat accumulating on his scalp. He closed his eyes and sighed.
I don't even have threats, Baja said.
It sounded like whining, even to him.
I don't even have that.
Yeah.
So I flew for the Mars Navy for 20 years, Alex said,
his eyes still closed.
Oh? Baja said.
He wasn't sure what the correct response was.
I was married,
Alex continued, moving his head around to let the cool air strike every part of his neck and face. Baja didn't reply. It had the feeling of a story, not a conversation. Alex would tell it or he wouldn't.
Life for a naval spouse is, frankly, pretty shitty, Alex said after a few moments. Typical tour on an MCRN boat can go from 90 days to 400, maybe 500 days. Depending on your MOS and fleet locations.
MOS? Baja asked before he could stop himself.
Your job. Anyway, while you're on a boat, your partner's back home doing whatever they do. A lot of folks do plural marriages, group partnerships, things like that. But I'm a one-woman kind of guy. And I guess she was a one-man kind of woman. So we did it the old-fashioned way. Baja nodded, even though Alex couldn't see him. When they were building new domes, Baja had done work that kept him at a surface camp for 4 or 5 days straight. His wife's medical practice wouldn't have let her travel with him, even if they hadn't had children. Those were long weeks. Baja tried to imagine stringing 10 or 20 of those weeks in a row, and failed.
But that meant she stayed home while I flew, Alex said after a quiet moment. She had her own work. Software engineer. Good one, too. So it's not like she was pining away at home for me. But still, if you love somebody, you want to be with them. And we loved each other. Faithful to each other, if you can imagine that. My tours were tough on us both. I'd get home and we'd break the bed.
Alex reached out and turned down the air vent, then spun his chair to face Baja. His broad, dark face held a sad smile.
It was a crap situation. But she stuck with me. Through 20 years of me being on ship, she stuck with me. And when I was in port, things were good. She'd work from home, and I'd take a lot of leave, and we'd wake up late and make breakfast together. Work in the garden.
Alex closed his eyes again, and for a moment, Baja thought he might have fallen asleep.
Ever been to Mars?
No, Baja replied. But my wife has.
The newer areas, the ones built after we had some idea of what folks need to feel happy, were built different. No more narrow stone corridors. They built wide corridors with lots of green space down the middle for plants.
Like on Ceres, Baja said. I've been to Ceres.
Yeah, that's right. They do that on Ceres, too. Anyway, you could apply for a permit to care for a section of that space. Plant what you wanted. We had a little chunk in the corridor outside our home. My wife planted an herb garden, some flowers, a few hot pepper plants. We'd work in it.
Sounds nice, Baja said.
Yeah.
Alex nodded, eyes still closed.
I didn't know it at the time, but it really was. I kind of thought it was a pain in the ass, to be honest. Never been much for gardening. But she liked it, and I liked her, and back then that was enough.
Did she die? Baja asked.
What? Goodness, no.
So what happened?
What happened is that she waited 20 years for me to retire, and I did. And then we didn't have to spend time apart anymore. She went to part-time with her work. I took a part-time gig flying suborbital shuttles. We spent a lot of time in bed.
Alex opened his eyes and winked. He seemed to be waiting for a response, so Baja said,
And then?
And then, one day, I put into port at the Mariner Orbital Transit, and while they were unloading my cargo, I almost walked into an MCRN recruiting office and signed up again.
Do they take?
No, I didn't do it, and yeah, I was too damn old anyway. But when I landed, we had a big fight over something stupid. I don't even remember what. Hell, I didn't know what we were fighting about even at the time. Except I sort of did.
Leaving?
No, actually. It was never about leaving her. I never stopped wanting to be with her. But I needed to fly. She'd waited 20 years for me, and she'd done it thinking we'd have all the time in the world after I was through. She'd done her tour just as much as I had. And she deserved the part that came after.
Baja felt what was coming like a punch in the stomach, unable to avoid comparing it to his own situation.
But you left anyway.
Alex didn't reply for a time, didn't move, just floated in the straps of his pilot's chair like a corpse in water. When he spoke again, his voice was strained and quiet, like a man admitting something shameful, hoping no one will hear. One day I left work at the transit office, and I walked across the street to the Pure and Clean Water Company, and I signed a 5-year contract to fly long-haul freighters out to Saturn and back. That's who I am. I'm not a gardener, or a shuttle pilot, or, turns out, a husband. I'm a long-flight pilot, pushing a little bubble of air-filled metal across an ocean of nothing is what I was born to do. You can't blame yourself for what happened, Baja started. No, Alex said, a deep frown cutting into his forehead. A person can fail the people they love just by being who they are. I'm who I am. And it wasn't what my wife wanted me to be. And something had to break. You decided to do what you did down on that planet, and it put you up here with me, instead of with your family. Alex leaned forward, grabbing Baja's hands in his own. It's still on you. I will never live down not being the person my wife needed after she spent 20 years waiting for me. I could never make that right. Don't go feeling sorry for yourself. You fucked up. You failed the people you love. They're paying the price for it right now. And you demean them every second you don't own that shit. Baja recoiled, as if from a slap to the face. He bounced off the chair and back into the straps, a fly caught in a spider's web. He had to stop himself from ripping at the straps to get free. When he'd stopped struggling, he said, "Then what?" "Shit," Alex said, leaning back. "I barely figured out my own mess. Don't ask me to figure out yours." "What was her name?" Baja asked. "Talissa," Alex said. "Her name is Talissa. Even just saying it makes me feel like 10 kilos of manure in a 5-kilo sack." "Talissa," Baja repeated. "But I can tell you this, I'll never let someone I care about down again. Never again. Not if I can help it. Speaking of which, I need to make a call," he said with a bright, frightening smile.
Chapter 26, Havelock. It was hard to say exactly what changed on the Edward Israel after they captured the saboteur, but Havelock felt it in the commissary and the gym, at his desk as he worked, and in the hallways as he passed by the crew members and RCE staff. Part of it was fear that someone had taken action directly against the ship. Part of it was excitement that after months of floating and frustration, something, anything, had happened that wasn't at ground level. But more than that, it felt to him like the mood of the ship had clarified. They were the Edward Israel, the rightful explorers of New Terra, and everyone was against them. Even the UN mediators couldn't be trusted. And so, strangely, they were free. The remaining crew of the Rosinante wasn't doing anything to change their opinions. "If you try to break orbit," the man on the screen said, "your ship will be disabled." His name was Alex Kamal, and he was the acting captain of the Rosinante. If RCE's intelligence was accurate, he was also the only remaining crew member of the corvette, and had the one remaining squatter terrorist on the ship with him, awaiting transport back to Earth for trial. Havelock crossed his arms and shook his head as the list of threats went on. "If we find that any harm has come to Naomi Nagata, your ship will be disabled. If she is subjected to torture, your ship will be disabled. If she is killed, your ship will be destroyed." "Well, ain't that just ducky," Captain Marwick said. "You recall we were talking about not having people want to kill my ship?" "It's just talk," Havelock said as Kamal went on. We have already sent our petition to the United Nations and Royal Charter Energy demanding Naomi Nagata's immediate and unconditional release.